Central Time, I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Dane County is the latest local government to put plans for a new youth detention facility on hold. We'll find out why and what it means for the state's plan to close the Lincoln Hills youth prison. First, for the last two centuries, rapid changes in technology have been changing our inner lives, how and what we feel and what it means to think of ourselves as humans. Today, skeptics and mental health professionals ask questions like, are our smartphones hurting us more than they're helping us? Is Google making us stupid? Is social media making us narcissistic? Those kinds of concerns about technology have been around a lot longer than you might think. 19th century Americans were known to chop down telegraph and telephone poles because they considered them to be disruptive to their lives. Our next guest tells those stories and more in their new book. Luke Fernandez is an assistant professor in the School of Computing and co-director of the Tech Outreach Center at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. Susan J. Matt is presidential distinguished professor of history at Weber State. Their book is called Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid: Changing Feelings About Technology from the Telegraph to Twitter. Both of you, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Glad to be here.
Well, Susan, let's start with you. What made you decide to dive in with this long-term view of how we react to new things like communication and information technologies?
Well, Luke and I both teach at a university, and several years ago, almost a decade ago, we noticed that our students seemed more distracted, and we thought it might have to do with technology. Luke applied for a grant and got it, and we taught a class exploring that, and we realized it wasn't just that our students were more distracted because of technology, but that other changes were happening to their personalities and psychology. Since I'm a historian, I was interested to see, is this just something that caused by social media, or are there longer stories to be told about how our technologies have transformed ourselves? And indeed, these stories are not just narratives that began 20 years ago, but in fact, the telegraph has changed us, the telephone has changed us. So we want to uncover the continuities and the discontinuities between past and present.
One running theme, though, in the book, Luke, that you say is kind of different in some ways is over time, we've felt like there are fewer and fewer limits on us, on what we have access to, on our abilities to communicate with the world. And that sounds like a good thing in some ways, but it doesn't always play out that way. Can you talk about how this kind of access changes the way we relate to the world?
Well, you know, we track six different emotions or mental states in the book: narcissism, loneliness, boredom, attention, awe, and anger. And, you know, we studied this over the course of 10 years, and we're trying to find some sort of commonalities between all of these emotions. And we decided what it really was this sense of sort of increasing sense of limitlessness, that we've become more sort of narcissistic over the last 200 years. That we're less tolerant of being alone, that we want more friends than ever before, that we're accustomed to want limitless entertainment, that we think that we can pay attention to more things, and that we're also in some ways more tolerant of anger than we were in the past. So this is sort of the connecting theme between all of these different six disparate stories about emotions.
I want to start digging into some of those emotions anyway. And Susan, let's start with that narcissism that Luke mentioned. We didn't always use that word necessarily, but even with the rise of things like being able to take pictures, photographs, and mirrors, there were concerns that this was increasing our vanity. Can you talk about how we started to think about our self-presentation with those two pieces of technology getting more common?
For sure. You know, for generations, theology had taught people that you should not be vain. You should not be proud. You should be humble and meek and aware of your frailties and also of your mortality. When people began to have access to photography, the first photography came to America in 1839, people began to come into photo studios. And there was a real debate over whether you should go get your picture taken. What was unique about photography was it democratized portraiture. Up to this point, you had to be pretty well off to have a picture painted of yourself. Some people thought photography would cure people of vanity because it wasn't as forgiving as an artist's hands who would smooth out your imperfections. It would show you in all your glaring reality. But in fact, people became pretty addicted to photography and to trying to present themselves in the best light possible in those photo studios, engaging in all sorts of tricks with 19th century photographers to make themselves look better, from having fake ankles hanging under their dress to posing with books they'd clearly never read. So photography certainly heightened people's preoccupations with self-presentation. Mirrors also got democratized in the late 19th century. They'd been pretty expensive, but by the end of the century, they're being mass-produced. And suddenly you can see in your house, in almost every room, how you look. And these are kind of instructing people. These technologies are instructing people to care about how they look and how they present themselves to the world.
But you also mentioned a point in the book that I thought was really interesting. Frederick Douglass is regarded by a lot of people as the most photographed human of the 19th century. And he took this and you write, really intentionally used that presentation, saying, okay, I'm getting these pictures taken of me to counteract the sort of the minstrel images and the stereotyped images of black people in the United States. So people used it intentionally in some interesting ways. Can you talk about that, Luke?
Yeah, I mean, often when we give presentations about this, I'll query the audience and ask them, who do you think was the most photographed person of the 19th century? And Frederick Douglass is not who people usually talk try to guess. They usually say Lincoln. And yeah, you know, Susan was just talking about all this form of photography that sometimes we use the anachronistic term Victorian selfies. There was a lot of self-portraiture in the 19th century that, if you look at it, looked very vain. And you can use those kind of pejorative terms to describe it. You know, people on the East Coast having these aspirational qualities to go west and become gold miners and then getting their pictures taken in front of big sacks of gold, even though they haven't been there yet. And similarly, those pictures that Susan was already talking about, women pretending to be more literary. But they weren't all of this portraiture wasn't vain, and Frederick Douglass is a sort of epitomizes that, because while he did have his picture taken an awful lot, it wasn't really sort of out of self-interest so much as you said, to try to counteract these negative stereotypes that people had at the time of black people. And by showing a much more sort of positive images of himself, he hoped to sort of counteract those stereotypes.
We're talking to Luke Fernandez and Susan Matt, authors of the book Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid, Changing Feelings About Technology from the Telegraph to Twitter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a piece of technology or communications technology in particular that came about in your lifetime that you made things better, worse, a little bit of both? Do you think kind of intentionally about how you use, say, social media or selfies? Call 800-642-1234. Susan, since the two of you wrote this book, we have this pandemic. And you had a recent piece, I think it was in the Washington Post, correct me if I'm wrong, but looking at you know, how we can use some of the lessons, especially when it comes to boredom in your book during this difficult time. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, you know, as Luke mentioned, 19th century Americans thought about their feelings differently than we did. And two we focused on in recent articles are boredom and loneliness, which seem appropriate for the pandemic. 19th century Americans were much more accustomed to solitude and to tedium, two things many of us are getting really familiar with during quarantining, self-isolating periods of the pandemic. So Americans kind of assumed these were part of the nature of life, that you were not always going to be constantly stimulated and entertained. And in fact, the word boredom in America didn't exist until the mid-19th century. Since its emergence and since modern psychologists have begun to think about boredom and modern entertainment industries have tried to make boredom a problem, we've become much more accustomed to constant stimulation, entertainment, excitement, amusement parks, movies. And so we're kind of conditioned to want more and more excitement all the time. So the pandemic has really thrown us for a loop. And we think looking back to earlier generations, emotional strategies may give us some guidance on how to cope.
Yeah, Luke, what kind of guidance do you think from your book that will help us maybe recapture, I don't know if we'd say a love of boredom and isolation, but not necessarily viewing them as negatives in and of themselves?
Right. Yeah. I don't think we want to be nostalgic for the 19th century, but certainly an iconic figure like Henry David Thoreau, who built a cabin beside Walden Pond and then proceeded to spend the next 2 years of his life alone, writing some of the more, you know, canonical texts of American thought, is one inspiration we could draw from, you know. And for Thoreau, this experience of being alone wasn't something that he regarded negatively. It was something that he celebrated. And I think part of what we're trying to do here is just sort of recall that there's more than one way to experience the experience of being alone. You can describe it with different words. In the 19th century, if you look on Google Ngram, for example, you can see this word usage across time. In the 19th century, the word solitude was used a lot more, whereas now, today, we use the term loneliness. And so if we think about our vocabulary and the words that we use to describe these experiences, and maybe we go back and try to use those words from the 19th century, we might be able to regard these trying times in perhaps a more positive light than we are when we just resort to, you know, our 21st century vocabularies.
We're talking to Susan Matt and Luke Fernandez, co-authors of the book Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid, Changing Feelings About Technology from the Telegraph to Twitter. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think technology has changed what it means to be and to feel human? How do you think it changes the way you feel? Do you worry about your relationship or our relationship to technology, social media, smartphones, and more? Do you feel like the ways we connect together make us feel disconnected sometimes? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We pick up our conversation with the co-authors of the book Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid, Changing Feelings About Technology from the Telegraph to Twitter. Susan Matt is a professor of history. Luke Fernandez, assistant professor in the School of Commuting, both at Weber State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about how things like smartphones, cell phones, the old phone changed our lives, the way we communicate with each other? Do you worry about social media? Do you feel like you spend too much time on it, or others around you spend too much time on social media without getting much out of it? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Susan, let's talk about social media. It comes up in a lot of the different emotions you talk about in the book, and I have a lot of mixed feelings about it. Some people love it, some people hate it, some people do both at the same time. How do you weigh the impact of our use of social media these days?
Well, you know, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are lots of things not to like about it, and I'm kind of a techno-skeptic. Luke is not. But we end up finding that when we did interviews with people from across the country, there were a lot of upside as well as down. For instance, I think a lot of us feel like social media may distance us from people, but in our conversations with immigrants, it was very clear how important things like FaceTime and Skype were to reach across borders when borders are closed. So we obviously see the positive. We worry that maybe sometimes it does make us feel like we are less aware of our limits than might be healthy.
Can you talk about the idea of being, intentional, Luke, about how we use a new kind of technology, whether that's, you know, sitting down in a camera studio in 1850 or taking a selfie in 2020, actually thinking about our relationship with the technology instead of just letting it wash over us?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, our book is not presented as a self-help book. I mean, it's a history book. But I think that we hope that when people read it, it can help to foster more intentionality. Because if you understand, or if you learn a little bit about the history of these different emotions and how they've been reshaped by technology in the world around us, perhaps we can use them in ways that are more intentional. We can recognize that it's more perilous or hazardous aspects and keep those at bay and leverage their more positive aspects. I mean, I think one example of this, for example, and you can sort of disaggregate it according to which emotion you're talking about. You know, we don't want to just talk about it in aggregate. You can unpack it. You can talk about, well, how does it affect my narcissism? How does it affect the way, does it make me more lonely, more bored? How does it affect my attention? One that I think doesn't get a lot of play, you know, in the media, but that we've focused on a bit, is how does it affect our ability to experience awe? And so asking these questions of ourselves in regard to specific emotions, I think, can make us speak with a bit more sort of precision and granularity about the way these technologies are affecting us, and then maybe use them with more intentionality.
Talking to Susan Matt and Luke Fernandez. They're the authors of the book Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid, Changing Feelings About Technology from the Telegraph to Twitter. Let's bring out a caller now. Ron is with us in Crandon. Ron, hi.
Hi. I was just wanted to comment on Walden by Thoreau. It always amazed me that even though the technology that he was talking about is so archaic now, the comments that he makes about it sound like they could have been made today. And where you're talking about changing views, you know, his views of the speed of information turning trivial news into something important and changing the face of things. Like I said, if you read it without context, you'd think that he was talking about things today.
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, what do you think?
Well, you know, he does have a wonderful quote saying, you know, we're building a telegraph to connect Maine to Texas, but it may well be that Maine and Texas have nothing useful to say to each other. Or that's an approximation of the quote. But the point is that not in every case is more connectivity the answer to all our woes. And we do know how often there is a lot of triviality that gets exchanged, as well as a lot of important material. But his hesitations were very timely. He also worries about people who go and check the mail all the time, which I often remember when I'm looking online. He thought you didn't have a very robust sense of self if you had to go to the post office all the time to look for new affirmation.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ron. We'll go to Carl now in Milton. Carl, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on something your guest said a few minutes ago. In regards to social media, just making us less aware of our limits. And I was thinking about calling and kind of saying that before I heard her say that. And I thought, yeah, I really resonate with that. I see that as a big problem because we're all exposed to all of the world's problems, essentially. And kind of the format of social media is, you know, it's asking you to comment, to you know, chime in and give your two cents in terms of what should be done about X or Y. And I don't think that's necessarily healthy. We have limits, and certainly we all should be, you know, working to make a better world, but we can't all solve every problem together.
Carl, thanks a lot for that call. Does that fit into the narcissism concept, Luke? I know about this problem, and therefore the world needs to know what I think about it.
Yeah, I was thinking more of our attention chapter there. Certainly, I think there's a connection to narcissism. But what the caller was talking about is, and in terms of intentionality, too, one of the myths that developed in the late 19th, early 20th century was this idea of sort of the 10% myth, that we were only using 10% of our brains, and that if we just sort of were a bit more mindful, that we could use the rest of it. And I think one thing that also we tend to think is that we have unlimited degrees of attention, that we can devote ourselves to, you know, that we can multitask and do many, many things at once. When in reality, our attention is limited. We can only pay attention to so many things. And with social media, there is this tendency, I mean, because social media companies make money off of hijacking our attention or getting our attention, that we should be cognizant of the fact that attention is not a limitless resource, even though oftentimes we think of it that way, and that we should sort of guard it closely. And then if we do, then we maybe need to be a little more careful about when we use social media and when we don't, and that we don't get into these sort of unhealthy habits of engaging in doom scrolling or just sort of endless scrolling. Because, you know, when we do that, at the end of the day, you know, you end up feeling like you haven't really done all that much, because all you've done is let your attention be taken from you by Facebook or Twitter.
In our last minute or so, Susan, has all the research that went into this book changed the way you relate to technology?
You know, it has. Both Luke and I agree that knowing how different models of being have changed over time, and knowing that we have some agency in deciding how to allocate our attention or how much attention to give to ourselves, how many social connections we should seek, whether we should really value constant stimulation, all of this research has really made us mindful about how we think about our own feelings, and wondering if there isn't a better way to act on them and shape them in the future.
It's a good place to leave it. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Luke, thanks for being with us. We've been talking to Luke Fernandez, assistant professor in the School of Computing and co-director of the Tech Outreach Center at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah, and Susan J. Matt, presidential distinguished professor of history at Weber State. They're co-authors of the book we've been talking about, Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid, Changing Feelings About Technology from the Telegraph to Twitter. Coming up after the news, we'll get an update on the plan to close the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison and replace it with regional facilities around the state. The plan, a long time coming, has run into some snags as local governments say they're not on board, at least with the current funding model. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, many colleges around the country plan to reopen for in-person classes this fall semester, but outbreaks of COVID-19 at some campuses have caused schools to rethink their plans. We'll talk to a higher education journalist about what administrators are weighing ahead of the school year. First, the state's plan to close the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison north of Wausau by July of next year is in doubt after Dane County and other local governments have turned down state funding to build new regional detention facilities. In 2018, former Governor Scott Walker ordered the closure of Lincoln Hills after repeated allegations of guards misusing force against inmates and ongoing staffing problems. Figuring out the funding for that plan has been a slow back and forth between the state and local governments, which has some officials saying the current timeline looks unrealistic. Brianna Riley covers state government and politics for the Cap Times. She's been reporting on this. Brianna, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, this has been a long-running story. Can you remind us of the original plan to close Lincoln Hills and its partner facility and replace it? What was that supposed to look like?
That's right. You summarized it nicely. In the last year of Governor Scott Walker's administration, a Republican, the legislature, in a very big bipartisan way, passed a bill to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, the state's two youth prisons in northern Wisconsin, replace them with regional facilities, and also overhaul more broadly youth criminal justice practices in Wisconsin. Fast forward, 2 years, and as you said, the process is in doubt. I mean, we've faced delays, overfunded or over budget options, and other setbacks along the way. And what happened last week is just the latest sort of move that has people wondering if this is actually a reality that'll happen by the July 1st, 2021 deadline.
Oh, yeah, Dade County, the latest. I think you write in your piece, Milwaukee County, Brown County. By my count, that's the top three biggest counties in the state by population. What is the snag? Why are these counties saying, hold on, maybe we can't build these local facilities?
Yeah, so those three counties, Brown, Dade, and Milwaukee, gave different reasons to the state on Friday. Friday was the deadline for them to go back to the Department of Corrections and say definitively whether they would accept state award funding to create these secure residential care centers for youth. This is just one part of the state's replacement plan for facilities to sort of direct the youth from Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake into following their closure. Anyway, there are different reasons. Brown County has a sort of more direct reason than Milwaukee and Dane counties, but Milwaukee and Dane are aligned in a way. They have concerns about funding. They have concerns about construction costs, ongoing operational funding, which isn't covered by the state at this point. And they're concerned about how COVID-19, how the pandemic exacerbates the local funding crises that they were facing.
As you said, the state passed this a couple years ago. Has the state's commitment to funding these local facilities changed in that time?
Well, officially, no. But we have seen some setbacks along the way. So for the secure regional or secure residential care centers on that side of things, we saw a process last summer that, you know, dragged into the fall, and the overall proposal that these four counties came up with combined to be tens of millions of dollars over budget. That kicked the plan to the legislature's powerful Joint Finance Committee, which in February sort of cut back the plan, specifically targeting Milwaukee County's plan. And then at that point, the Joint Finance Committee, you know, the legislature's most powerful budget committee, they declined to take up funding for Type 1 facilities. Type 1 facilities are the other major component of this plan. Basically, they're the facilities, the two state-run facilities, that would house the more severe youth offenders. So without that piece of it, there was already questions, you know, 7 months ago about how the state was going to be able to meet next summer's deadline. The other component of this that I do want to mention, because it's right here in Madison, and we are a local paper at the Gap Times, is there is a component of funding for the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center that was included in the original bipartisan bill that passed the legislature and was signed into law by Governor Walker, but that has also not yet been funded by the legislature. So all of these components are hanging out there, and we're seeing pieces slowly falling off as we get closer and closer to that July 1st, 2021 deadline.
Talking to Brianna Riley from the Cap Times, talking about the efforts to replace the state's youth correctional facilities with local facilities more spread out around the state, snags in the funding, casting the timeline into doubt. So, Brianna, what happens now if all these counties are saying, yeah, no, we can't do this? Is there any action at the state level now to try to change the plan?
That's a great question. At this point, it's very unknown what will happen. One of the women, actually, who was a very prominent voice on the Juvenile Grant Committee that reviewed and worked with the counties on their applications for secure residential care centers, is hoping that the state can use this moment as a way to kind of rethink the approach to begin with. I mean, the reality is we might just very well see another legislative bill to push the deadline back further. The legislature last year, I believe, passed a trailer bill to their original bill that would extend the deadline to close Lincoln Hills by 6 months. So that's how we got to the July 1st, 2021 deadline. Realistically, the easiest solution would be just extending that out more. But this woman, Charlene Moore, really hopes that the state instead can use this as a way to sort of reassess the entire plan, look at what might have gone wrong, and see if there are still options to really do work overhauling the state's approach to youth criminal justice from the ground up.
Now, all along, the thing driving this was, I think, an agreement from all stakeholders that Lincoln Hills, the current system where all these youth go to one place in Wisconsin, isn't working. But I guess while it's delayed, that's still what we got, right?
That's right. In Dane County specifically, transfers from the county to Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake were delayed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Right now, those transfers are now being accepted. So as of Monday, we had 13 youth in those facilities. But yeah, I mean, one of the concerns with Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, in addition to, you know, staff abuses and other things that really made headlines here, is the reality that it is in northern Wisconsin, and many of the youth that the juveniles that are housed there are from the southeastern parts of the state. So the idea was to make facilities that were more acceptable to the juveniles, to their families, but we're at a point now where it's essentially, you know, blown up. I mean, I don't see any path forward at this point to be able to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake by July 2021, and put those, there'd be no place to put those juveniles.
What are local governments doing in the meantime? I know at some points during the midst of the Lincoln Hills fiasco at its worst, some judges were doing everything they could to not send youth to Lincoln Hills. Do we know, is that still something that's happening? Are they trying to avoid using that facility as much as possible?
That's right. There are still diversion efforts underway, you know, to avoid as much as possible sending youth to those facilities. I believe when I spoke to Racine County's Hope Otto, who was in charge of the county's plan, and they're the one county that's still going full speed ahead with this at this point. She had said that, you know, for a while now, they hadn't been sending youth to Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. So we see other counties around the state, you know, doing this and looking very closely at what options they have available for youth in their communities. But without these expanded centers in the case of Dane County, or these new facilities in the case of Brown County, those options are a little bit more limited now.
What are you watching for next on this story, Brianna?
Definitely want to see how legislators react. It's been a really busy news week, so I haven't been able to follow up as much as I would have liked to with the heads of the Joint Finance Committee, the heads of both parties in the state Senate and Assembly, but their reaction is key. So is Governor Evers. I mean, maybe we'll see something in his budget proposal trying to address this again. He, you know, proposed similar things this current session in his initial budget. But, you know, we'll see where the legislature ends up and what their commitment to closing these facilities really looks like.
Brianna, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brianna Riley covers state government and politics for the Cap Times. She talked with us about Dane County and other local governments turning down state funding for new youth detention centers and what it means for the plans to close the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison in northern Wisconsin. Coming up, a higher education journalist tells us how colleges are reopening and in some cases reclosing their campuses for the fall semester amid the COVID-19 pandemic. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, airlines have been hit hard by the pandemic. An industry analyst tells us how they're trying to bounce back, stay safe, and convince passengers that it's all right to fly. First, colleges and universities have developed plans to return to campus this fall amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Many schools plan on resuming at least some classes in person while also having some instruction online. But large outbreaks of the virus early in the semester at two high-profile universities, Notre Dame and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, have schools reconsidering their plans. Our next guest joins us to talk about how schools are weighing both safety and financial considerations as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. Scott Jasek is editor of Inside Higher Ed. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Before we dig into some particular cases here, Scott, I wouldn't want the job of a university administrator trying to navigate this. How complicated a situation is this for campuses around the country?
It's very complicated. They have everyone who, pretty much everyone, thinks they're doing the wrong thing, whatever they do. And they have incredible financial situation, and they have people's health and safety. So they may not be doing what you want or what an individual wants, but they've got a tough job.
Now, we've got these two high-profile cases. University of North Carolina opened and closed or went virtual. University of Notre Dame, mm-hmm. same thing. Michigan State saying we were going to go live, we're going virtual. how are other schools reacting to this now? Ones that, like here in Wisconsin, maybe weren't planning on opening in person for a week or two yet.
Well, like North Carolina State today just announced that they are going to be virtual, and they were in person for some classes. The problem, what's happening is at places that are bringing students back, most students are following the instructions, but some students are not. And they're having parties, and they are endangering themselves, and COVID spreads. And the universities are left with a situation of figuring out, how can I possibly defend keeping students on campus, endangering the faculty, and endangering the local community?
Apart from efforts to get kids not to party, what are some of the safety precautions, some of the most common safety precautions you've seen campuses take if they're trying to do in-person learning?
So if they're trying to do in-person learning, one is keeping the students separate from themselves. So a lot of campuses have gone to just single rooms and dorms, or just double rooms and what used to be triples. They are requiring them to wear a face mask on campus, even when they are not in class. They are requiring social distancing. They are not having the dining halls open, but just distributing boxes of food. So if you're open, it's a very different experience.
For those going online and virtual, is there a sense that they maybe have things a little more ready to rock than, you know, when they had to turn on a dime in the spring?
In some cases, yes. The faculty who have been planning for this have had more time to plan, and you can do distance learning better when you plan for it. On the other hand, many faculty are once again just deciding at the last minute to switch, or the university is deciding to switch, so they don't have as much time.
Let's look at the financial side of things. How has COVID-19 hit the financial outlook of colleges and universities?
It's a disaster for them. They are losing money on both the things that they need to do to allow students to study, but also because some students aren't going. I just wrote about community colleges, for instance. Some community colleges have 30% fewer students than they'd expected. A community college or any college can't really afford to run like that.
I know some people, as you mentioned, nobody's going to be happy with all the decisions. Some have criticized, I see out there, campuses that tried to reopen, saying that's motivated primarily by financial considerations, that worry that if they go virtual, they're going to lose those out-of-state students who don't want to pay out-of-state to look at a screen all day.
Yeah.
Is that, I don't know, is that a fair criticism, do you think?
It's a common criticism. I'm not sure it's a fair criticism. Look, the colleges want to be open. They want, it's what they do, and it's what they do well. And so they wanted to see if they could be open. The large universities are the ones that are most likely to be changing right now. The smaller liberal arts colleges, in some ways, are just starting up. And it will be a real test to see if they can manage it in person.
Talking to Scott Jasek, editor of Inside Higher Ed, looking at the tough decisions facing campuses around the country to open in person during COVID-19, to reclose as a couple big names have done already after outbreaks in the first week of classes. I want to look at a couple other stakeholders here. We hear a lot about instructors and students. There's a lot of staff at these faculties, the custodians, the people who work, in student counseling, the cafeteria staff. Are they being factored into these decisions?
Well, it varies how much they are in these decisions. But for instance, custodians and the people who clean the campus, a lot more is being expected of them than before. It's not that campuses were filthy before, but there's a much higher concern for cleanliness. And so that's very important. Dining service workers, many of them are being laid off because of different ways to serve the students. And overall, And then student affairs people have to learn how to serve students remotely. Some already know that, but a lot of campuses, this is brand new information.
And now more stakeholders, people live in college towns who don't have any direct relationship with the college or university. Are you seeing communities saying, hey, be careful before you turn my town into a new hotspot?
Yeah, well, the communities have really changed. Initially, they were like, come back, please come back. A lot of the restaurants and bars shut down or were closed at the height of the spring COVID closings. And they wanted to reopen. Now that it looks like they are reopening, a lot of them are saying, hey, wait, we don't want the COVID. On the other hand, the bars and restaurants are opening in college towns. I don't know what it's like in Madison, but they're really of multiple minds on this issue.
A common theme in COVID is that it tends to hurt older people more, people with pre-existing conditions. There's a sense that maybe college-age people aren't at risk. But we're seeing in the news today, a quarterback at Georgia State, freshman there, says, I'm out for the season, heart condition linked to surviving COVID-19. Yeah. Can you talk about how people are evaluating the health risks?
Well, I think it is not true that young people don't get COVID. The places that shut down have been shutting down because they've had massive outbreaks of COVID. Now, hopefully no one will die from those, but it is a very serious thing to have happen. And then you mentioned the older people. Well, guess what? The faculty is older, or some of them are in that age group, and they have to teach these students. So the policies are all over the place.
Do you see this all having a long-term impact on the future of campuses around the country?
Yeah. I mean, we've already seen some very small colleges close, and I suspect we will see some more close. Those are generally small private colleges or colleges that were already in some trouble. But depending on how long this goes on, this could have a major impact on higher education. Madison is not going to shut down because of this, but a lot of campuses are in danger by this.
So what shoes are you waiting to drop now, Scott, as the news is changing from day to day on campuses?
Yeah, it's really changing rapidly. The thing that I would like to see is, are there campuses that manage to open safely? And different kinds of campuses, large, small, whatever. Is there a way to do it right? And there's a lot of interest in that. Or is there just no way to do it right for a large campus or for a small campus?
Have any schools reopened and people are looking at them as success stories, even though we're still early in the fall term?
Way too early. I don't want to declare anyone a success.
So, Scott, as we wrap up just in our last minute here, what kind of questions are you hearing campus officials, looking to outside agencies, the federal government, others, trying to get answered as they make these decisions?
Well, they wish the federal government were more active. There's been very little federal guidance, but there has been a lot of state guidance, a lot of, New York State, California issued guidance for what campuses need to do to reopen. And I imagine there's something in Wisconsin, too. They want clear instructions on what they can do. And colleges, colleges are rule followers. If you give them instructions, they can do them. But the federal government has really given them very little.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Scott Jasek is the editor of Inside Higher Ed. He joins us today to talk about how college campuses are deciding whether or not to reopen for in-person instruction during the COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen two high-profile universities open in person and, after a week, switch to online after COVID-19 outbreaks. We want to hear from you. If you are preparing for the fall term here in Wisconsin or elsewhere, your faculty, staff, student, parent maybe getting ready to send your kid to school or wondering if you're going to be sending your kid to school in person, we would love to hear from you what you're looking at, what you're experiencing and thinking. You can email us right now, ideas@wpr.org. wpr.org. Again, that's ideas@wpr.org, and share your story. There's a new computer game out that's getting a lot of buzz, mostly for the right reasons and for some unintended funny moments. The game is Microsoft's new version of Flight Simulator. That's where you get to take the controls of a wide variety of airplanes and fly them just about anywhere in the world. I've played a lot of computer games in my life. The Flight Simulator genre is not one I got into. It requires a lot of patience and attention to detail. For people who know me, it may come as a shock to know that those are not my strong points. Anyhow, the new game is getting a lot of positive comments online, in part because it uses real-world map data to let you simulate flying over a lot of the real world. But there are some glitches. The biggest one so far, a narrow but extremely tall obelisk in the middle of Melbourne, Australia, which does not exist in the real world. Fans of the game have taken pride in flying past the mysterious structure or even landing on it in a biplane. Apparently, that building was created by a typo in a real-world mapping program. Instead of entering it as a two-story building, someone entered it as a 212-story building. Some other glitches came along when the programming language filled in some gaps in the maps. Buckingham Palace, it's gone. The British royal family now lives in an office building. The Washington Monument is a narrow skyscraper. And palm trees in Los Angeles show up as a mysterious stone pillar. Fortunately, none of those glitches interfere with a flying experience, except be careful in downtown Melbourne. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.